Hi, welcome to Blogging Heads.
Hi, Mark. How are you?
Good, very good. I'm Mark Schmidt. I'm the executive editor of the American Prospect magazine and website, prospect.org.
And I'm Josh Cohen. I teach at Stanford in political science, philosophy, and law. And I am editor of Boston Review and, I guess, of the Boston Review website, bostonreview.net.
Okay, great. Are you permanently at Stanford now, Josh?
I'm permanently here, yeah. Some you might say here for good, but why evaluate?
Well, none of us are here for good, but or anywhere
That's
for good.
Right. But, right. Yes, I moved here I was at MIT for a long time, and then I moved here in 2006.
Okay. Yeah. I don't keep track of the academic job shifts as much as I should.
You probably have a million or 2 million better things to do than that. And, it's a waste of time to keep track of it.
If Lingua Franca magazine were still around, I'd probably be on top of these things.
That's right.
So speaking of academia, I actually wanted to kind of get your take on one of your own real specialties, which is the article that Bill Galston wrote in the New Republic the other day about the political philosopher John Rawls, who was a mentor to you, and the newly released it's his senior thesis, which reflects Rawls's more religious outlook, but also Galston touched on this argument about how Rawls isn't that useful for liberal politics, and I'm interested in.
Right.
I'm sort of interested in your take on that debate.
So, I'm going to hold up the book recently published to the camera. It's called A Brief Inquiry into the Meaning of Sin and Faith. And the book includes an undergraduate thesis that Rawls wrote at Princeton in the fall of 1942, which a professor in religious studies at Princeton, wonderful person Eric Gregory, discovered a couple of years ago. Nobody had ever read it or talked about it, and Rawls never talked about it. Anyway, it was written in the fall of 1942, before Rawls went into the service where he fought in the Pacific, and it was written at a time that Rawls went through what he would later describe as a kind of orthodox Episcopalian, very religious phase of his life that led him to consider going into the ministry after he contemplated going into the ministry before he went into the service, although he lost his orthodox faith while he was in the service. So the book includes this undergraduate thesis and a set of unpublished reflections that Rawls did in the 1990s after he had retired as a professor of philosophy at Harvard.
Was it known that he was more religious when he was younger?
Yes.
I read the biographical part in that Samuel Freeman book about him,
yes.
And that seemed to, as I recall, that touched on his more religious
use. Yes, people who knew him knew that he had contemplated going into the ministry, but no one had ever read anything that was written from within that period, and I think all of us who read the thesis as part of a discussion that led to a decision to publish it, which was a complicated decision to make, were startled, surprised by the experience of reading something. This is, John Rawls, who is widely agreed to be the great secular, liberal, political, Anglo-American political philosopher of the 20th century, and he writes an undergraduate thesis about faith, sin, and community that says that it's founded on a few basic propositions, the first of which is that there exists a God who revealed himself in Jesus Christ.
Right.
And
but you couldn't even really get away with writing it in a senior thesis today.
Well,
you could in a few places, obviously, yeah.
Yeah, it was an unusual unusual thing. And then Tom Nagel, a philosopher from NYU, and I wrote an introduction to the book, and there were a few points, and this will get us to the Galston's comments and criticisms in the New Republic, there were a few points that we emphasized. One was that there's a very striking resonance between this work of a 21-year-old high Episcopalian, neo-Orthodox, moral theologian about a set of criticisms of the idea of desert, merit and desert, that resonate very strongly with the more egalitarian aspect of Rawls's mature political philosophy, his idea that you should only have inequalities that work to the maximal advantage of the least advantaged, and that the idea of desert and ideas of desert and merit have no role in determining fair shares in a just society. A second point that Nagel and I emphasize in our essay is that there's a striking similarity at a more, even more abstract level between the thesis and the later work, in that Rawls thinks of morality in the early work as a matter of the conduct of interpersonal relations, of how you relate to other people, kind of I-thou relations. He says that we shouldn't think of morality as a matter of figuring out what the greatest good is and how we ought to conduct ourselves in order to achieve that greatest good in the spirit of a Plato or an Aristotle or of certain elements of the Christian tradition. So the critique of desert, strong resonance, emphasis on morality is about interpersonal relations, very strong resonance. And then there was a third point and Tom and I both thought was particularly interesting, which is that this thesis, written at age 21, is a work of moral theology that has no conception at all of politics. There's nothing in it about law. There's nothing in it about democracy. I don't believe the word rights occurs any place in the undergraduate thesis, and it is about 200 pages and very wide-ranging. And ideas about pluralism, religious pluralism or social pluralism, also play no role. And this seemed to us to be a very large difference between the early Rawls and the mature Rawls, who emphasizes the kind of autonomy of political life and political life having its own principles and values that are required by the existence of religious disagreement and pluralism. Okay, so those are
right.
Now,
although some of that comes in later, like that's the confrontation with pluralism isn't really there in Theory of Justice, right? It kind of comes in more in political liberalism?
Much more forcefully in political liberalism than in Theory of Justice, that's absolutely right. And pluralism is there in a way, but his later book published in 1993, Theory of Justice is 1971, later book published in 1993, Political Liberalism, is centrally concerned with the fact that in a liberal democratic society, you expect there to be a population animated by fundamentally different and conflicting religious and moral and philosophical and metaphysical convictions, and that what you really need to do is to find some kind of common public terrain of argument that they can occupy in politics. Now, so Bill Galston wrote a short essay on this in the New Republic, and while I disagree with a bunch of things that Bill says, he's a very, very thoughtful guy about everything, I think. And while I disagree with what he says, I think he touches exactly on the most striking issues. The first one, he says, is, the young Rawls offers us a critique of ideas about desert and merit, which he associates with a conception of sin. He associates ideas of desert and merit with the idea that you can make demands on God, which he thinks is sin, theologically inappropriate.
Who thinks that theologically inappropriate?
Rawls, in this thesis. So let me just to make this a little more textured, let me read to you something that Rawls writes, in this now published undergraduate thesis. He says, the human person once perceiving that the revelation of the word is a condemnation of the self, casts away all thoughts of his own merit. He sees that the givenness of God is everywhere prevenient, and that he possesses nothing that has not been given. He knows that what he has received has been given by some other, and that ultimately all good things are the gift of God. And then he goes
and,
on
and you
to
could
say...
See, you could see how you could just strip that sentence of God, and you have theory of justice, right?
And let me read you the next paragraph where it's stripped for most of it, and you're predicting. That's a perfect prediction. He says... This is, you can lay a passage from Theory of Justice alongside this, and it's, he says, the more he examines his life, the more he looks into himself with complete honesty, the more clearly he perceives that what he has is a gift. Suppose he was an upright man in the eyes of society. Then he will now say to himself, and he has quotes around this, so you were an educated man, yes, but who paid for your education? So you were a good man and upright, yes, but who taught you your good manners and so provided you with good fortune that you did not need to steal? So you were a man of loving disposition and not like the hard-hearted, yes, but who raised you in a good family, who showed you care and affection when you were young so that you would grow up to appreciate kindness? Must you not admit that what you have received, then be thankful and cease your boasting? It's also this wonderful sort of
almost like Passover Seder-like tone to it, doesn't it?
Well, he was thinking of becoming a minister, and wouldn't have been bad at it. Now, Galston worries, and maybe asserts, but at least worries, that the critique of desert that's associated with Rawls's mature egalitarianism is inextricably tied to this conception of human beings as having no merit, as deserving nothing from God.
Right.
And there's a different view that you could have about this. You could say that here's Rawls, a morally serious and maybe morally anxious 21-year-old, who has what I think is, for many people, a kind of moral intuition that what good fortune they have as a matter of luck. This is the theme of Malcolm Gladwell's new book, Outliers.
Right.
This is not a particularly religious idea. It's a secular idea that you owe your good fortune to luck. And that what he then did, writing in 1942, lacking any other moral vocabulary for expressing this, having been brought up in a conventionally religious background, he then decides to put this moral point in a religious language, and then later he extracts the point from that religious language, so that it wasn't, you know, originally or essentially or inextricably a religious point. But I think, you know, it's a fair question that Galston raises, how do you take the idea that we don't deserve anything because we can't make demands on God and turn it into a critique of the idea of desert as a basis for determining fair distributive shares?
Right.
I think there is this common experience of the fortuitousness of good fortune, and then also something that Rawls worried about that I think Hayekians also worry about, which is that we don't really have a kind of an agreement on a conception of merit or a conception of desert, and we need to find some other basis for distributive fairness.
Right.
But for Bill, though, I think for Bill Galston, there's a larger issue that's at stake here, which is that he thinks that Rawls was never really a political thinker,
right,
that he was a moralist,
right,
who then adopted a kind of political position, but that he never really wrestled with the kind of issues of political competition and the need for coercion and problems about, you know, war and violence. And that his outlook remained a kind of, retained a kind of otherworldly, anyway, a kind of high moralism. I mean, he said, Bill says at the end of his thing that if we look at political life from too high an altitude, then we can no longer see it as it is.
Right.
And I, the thing that troubles me about that is that it's, you could equally well say that if you look at political life from too low an altitude, then you'll never be able to see it as it might be.
Right. That's right. That's right.
And, you know, I think that kind of, you know, metaphor of seeing it from too high an altitude is too abstract a metaphor. I think what Rawls thought was, and I think rightly thought, was that politics is not exclusively a contest over power, where, you know, competing groups try to advance their interests. It's always, at least in part, sometimes a larger part, sometimes a smaller part, an effort to act in ways that are animated by moral and political principles.
Right.
It's Lincoln's idea that you have a country that's conceived in an idea of liberty, dedicated to a proposition that we're all created equal. I don't think Lincoln failed to understand politics or saw it from too high an altitude when he said that the country was built not around a constitution, but around an idea and a proposition.
Right.
So I think, as I say, I think that, you know, Galston gets, you know, he's put his finger on a very deep and important problem, but I think he's a little too quick to...
Well, that was the aspect of it that most interested me, although I'm kind of interested in the development of Rawls. I'm not, you know, I'm not immersed in it as a, as an academic,
yeah.
And I've only read, I guess, the two major books and a little bit of other material. But it's always been, as somebody who's mostly been closer to the real world of politics, I love Rawls, and I find it sort of, its detachment kind of bracing and useful, not in the sense that this is my guide to the actual political world, but that it kind of helps structure that, you know, backdrop of your thinking about what justice
right.
really is, and as you put it very well, what politics can be. So, it's not like I want Rawls to be something different. In a way,
right.
I kind of want it to be what it is, even though that's not all. You know, that's not the only guide to life that I have. And I find I'm sort of interested in this. In this argument about the utility of Rawls, and like, why do people expect it to serve that purpose? You know, why? I mean, obviously there is political philosophy that's much more useful to the, I mean,
yeah.
Machiavelli. I mean, obviously there's tons of political
yeah, yeah,
philosophy
yeah.
that's actually much more useful to the to your kind of ground game, as it were. But this isn't, and I think it's a little bit linked. I think this comes up more and more because of this kind of claim from the right, from the political conservatism, that they're grounded in political philosophy, whether it's Hayek or Locke
right.
or whatever. They have this grounding in political philosophy, and what do liberals have except their feelings? And
yeah.
there isn't a common... So sometimes people
yeah.
look to Rawls because that is actually the common thing, you know, that every pretty well-educated undergraduate, you know... who's taken any kind of political theory class will have read at least Theory of Justice. I mean, it is the closest you can get to a common theme in modern
yeah.
political philosophy that most liberals will be roughly familiar with. But that doesn't
That's
mean
right.
it's our, you know, guide to living, right? I mean...
It's neither a guide to living nor a guide to what tax policy
right.
should be this, or
right.
next week
right.
or this year.
Right.
But I think there's a basic point that... I mean, you might say, look, it's not a guide to conduct, but it is a kind of orientation.
Right.
And to unpack that idea of providing, I mean, I'm agreeing with what you say by talking about it's like the in the backdrop. And I think that's how Rawls thought about
right.
it. And I think the basic point of orientation is this. It's been a common theme in political thought, I don't know, I'll make up a number, 100, let's call it 150 years, that there, and you can find strong statements of this in a Hayek or in a Milton Friedman, that there's a fundamental conflict between liberty and equality. And you can endorse liberty,
right.
or you can endorse equality, Or maybe as a practical matter, you can have a kind of ramshackle compromise between them to build a political coalition. But these are really fundamentally warring political values, and you have to decide. Now, Rawls defends a different proposition. He defends an ideal of egalitarian liberalism, a political philosophy. He called it justice as fairness, that says you don't have to choose between liberty and equality. You can have a political ideal that reconciles both of them. Now, I think that if you come, and then he gives content to that. He's got a principle of equal basic liberties, and he's got a principle of equality of opportunity, and then this egalitarian idea, the difference principle. You don't have inequalities except that work to the maximum benefit.
Right.
So he gives content to that idea. But I think it really makes a difference when you're coming at political life, real political life, on the ground, maybe not quite the ground game, but in the policy world and in the world of the, it really makes a difference if you think that a commitment to liberty and a commitment to equality are really parts of a single coherent political philosophical program, or if you think that these are basically warring political values. I think Rawls did something that John Stuart Mill did in the middle of the 19th century, which is to say these are, you know, both important and mutually involving. And I think in that respect, it is a fundamentally different political philosophy from what you get from the classical liberal tradition, whose high expression is Hayek.
Right, right. Now, it's also, there are also cases where that question of what's deserved really plays out in real politics. I mean, that's also a live question, as you know, that actually plays out in tax policy. So that, you know, the idea that every inequality is based on somebody working harder than somebody else, or something, or is somehow earned, versus feeling like this is just your good fortune, and as a result of this good fortune, you actually owe something back, is, you know, plays out every day.
Absolutely, I think that's it's a very good example. How you argue, I think this is maybe my professional deformation. I'm a philosopher, so there you go. I mean, I think these things about how you argue for public policy really matter, and if you think that people who have more are owed more, or they deserve more, or they merit more, it's a reward for something that's really fundamental about who they are and what they've done. It gives you a very different outlook from the outlook that you have when you think, I'm working hard, and it's my good fortune to be able to work hard.
Right.
So I think the basic point here on which I guess I disagree with Bill, apart from the dessert issue, is that I think that for the polemical purposes of this article, Bill Galston maybe is a little bit harder on the idea of about the relevance of moral argument in politics than he probably would be in other settings.
Right. It got me thinking about these issues. It gave me an excuse to ask you about it.
And speaking of moral issues in politics, I think we were going to talk about the recently released torture memos,
right? Where neither liberty nor equality are well respected.
I think that's a fair statement. Right. Although I suppose there's one aspect of equality. Odd way in here, maybe, but there's one aspect of equality that's particularly disrespected. There's a moment in one of the memos from 2005. These are the ones that are signed by Bradbury, not the Bibby 2002 memo, where the memo observes that State Department human rights reports condemn human rights violations of other countries in the world, where the human rights violations are a matter of using the methods of interrogation
right.
that are being approved of in these memos.
Right.
And so there is a kind of okay for us, not for you, but right. not for you.
Right.
And, you know, these are legal memos. I don't know, Derek, you don't have any legal training.
I don't really know.
I don't.
Period.
Well, I, you know, as you can tell, I'm not about to move into a criticism of you for. But what you do if you're, thinking like a lawyer is having an ability to draw distinctions
right.
Between the case at issue and other cases. So you have to draw a distinction here.
Right.
And the distinction that's drawn in this memo is, look, it's different when we do it because we only do it to protect. The national interest,
right. as if other countries
and to avoid
don't.
Serious harm, and these guys just do it for the hell
right.
of it. But here, I'm just guessing now, Mark. Yeah. Maybe you guess differently. I'm just guessing. My guess is that if you asked people using these methods of so-called coercive interrogation, some people might call them torture, like the current Attorney General, for example. You look in other countries that are using these things that are being condemned by the United States State Department for human rights violations in virtue of their using these things. My guess is that people there are sitting around saying we're only doing this because it's needed in order to protect the national
right.
interest.
Right, absolutely.
There's something right. particularly.
I mean, not all of them are. Not all of them have that process where they need to say it.
Yes.
You know, I mean, they just
yes.
do it. I mean, there's not to say that. Conversation in every country, but that doesn't, I mean, that's not even really relevant.
I think that's right.
I mean, I kind of been waiting for these memos. I thought the outrageousness of the fact that the legal opinion mm-hmm. would be secret was really disturbing to me, and I couldn't really, I guess I was really surprised by them because of the extent to which they were not actually legal memos. They were extensive explanations of specific methods.
Yeah.
You know, so that the reasoning was, there were little tidbits of reasoning about the actual law, more in the later memos than in the earlier ones. That it was so excruciatingly detailed and specific, which made it, you know, just horrifying to read, and the ritualistic nature of something like this put through the legal process makes it even more horrifying. I mean, that's why I used to be a little bit ambivalent about the death penalty and about capital punishment. And I could sort of see in an abstract sense that it's, you know, that there are crimes so heinous and so mm-hmm. forth. But the ritualisticness of the state putting a person to death is actually so horrifying. That's actually the root of my opposition to it. I mean, all the rituals we do to prevent people from committing suicide and the whole last meal, it's all actually more horrifying than the act itself, I think. And you got some of that here, this elaborate legal ritual, which in the end, though, it really made me, to me, I think the obvious backstory to these memos was, you know, somebody in the CIA being told by Cheney's office or whatever, you got to do this, you got to do that, and basically mm-hmm. saying, I'm not doing anything yeah. unless I get a legal memo that says absolutely to the letter. And I don't want a legal memo that yeah. says,
right.
you know, has, you know, shocks the conscience or any of these, yeah. you know, vague words that leave it on, that put the responsibility on me. I want every single thing written out, as you might sometimes with, you know, if you're being asked yeah. to do something that you actually think is illegal, you're going to say, I want a letter from a lawyer that tells me, you know, every I dotted, every T
right.
crossed, exactly what I'm doing. And that's, I guess that made me realize the memos themselves, I guess I didn't expect that the memos themselves would actually contain that level of detail. Which actually made me, in the end, made me more comfortable with the idea that of not prosecuting the individual CIA agents.
Obviously,
there's a lot we don't know. I don't know where culpability right. lies. I don't know, you know, right. I'm not going to...
Well, we're in this awkward, you know, complicated... Yeah. complicated awkward. Yeah. There's a kind of circle here.
Right.
So Obama says, first of all, just on background, it should be said here, as a matter of fact, that the Obama administration gets some credit for releasing these things. They were under a lot of pressure not to release them.
But they were also under pressure to release under a court order to release them.
But that, I mean, we shouldn't, you know, the ACLU gets the principal credit here, and I think it's very important to keep that in mind.
Right.
But here's the circle that we're in that's, I think, really, you know, bothers me. So you got the perps, and the perps are covered by the memo. They're told it's okay to do this, and they can't really be, you know, they're not doing anything wrong if they do these things, etc.
Right.
Okay, so then you say, all right, so really what we should do is go after the lawyers. Well, no, you can't go after the lawyers because the lawyers aren't the policymakers.
Right.
They're just giving a legal opinion. Ah, okay, we're not going to go after the perps and we're not going to go after the lawyers. Let's go after the policymakers. No, you can't go after the policymakers because the policymakers also go to the lawyers.
Right, right.
And they say, is this all okay?
Right.
I mean, I've
heard,
you know, then Condoleezza Rice say that, you know, in reference to discussions that took place on the principals committee, of which she was chair, 2002, when these issues were being discussed, that she went to the, you know, attorney general and was very concerned to make sure that the kinds of treatment that were being discussed on the principals committee were legal. So everybody's got something covered, and I'm sympathetic with your view. You don't go after the perps unless they violated the rules that they were being told to follow. I don't think it's so obvious that you shouldn't go after the lawyers, and some of the lawyers, including John Yoo, have been in court already. He was in court in San Francisco a few weeks ago because he's being sued by Padilla under a constitutional tort. And I think that, but above all, I think it's important to do something about the policymakers.
Right. Right.
Because here's the kind of thing I can't get away from. I mean, you know, the Attorney General says, repeating a familiar slogan, nobody's above the law. He also says, and this is agreed in all of these memos, that torture is against the law.
Right.
So, from which it follows that if somebody commits torture, there's a legal action that is appropriate to bring against them. Now, Holder thinks that waterboarding is torture.
Right.
And the memos deny that waterboarding is torture. But look, if waterboarding is torture, and that's not a close, you know, it's not a close call, then people who said that it isn't torture and people who said that it should be done are legally culpable.
I'm not even sure it's quite as complicated as you put it. And just because something
I get paid for making things
something just because something is presented under the color of being a legal opinion doesn't make it a legal opinion. And it is a sense. I mean, you know, obviously the Office of Professional Responsibility and Justice maybe has some. It's not the kind of issue you face a lot, but obviously in that interaction between the policy memos, policymakers, particularly Cheney and Addington and so forth, and the lawyers, with the policymakers demanding a certain result from the lawyers and the lawyers providing it with the thinnest attempt, if any, and sometimes almost no attempt to actually deal with it in any legal way, including that's consistent through the entire U Bybee Bradbury period on the wireless on the wiretapping and everything else. You know that you can't sort of say, "Oh, it's a legal. It's just the best legal opinion." It's not even any kind of legal opinion. But we don't quite have the tools for that. But we shouldn't pretend that these are legal opinions.
Yeah, I mean, you know, John Yoo has described himself as part of the War Council.
Right.
You know, not just the High Court
here.
There's something. Did you watch the Rachel Maddow interview with Colin Powell?
No. I did.
So this was a couple of weeks ago. It was very interesting. She was pressing him on what happened at these principals committee discussions about methods of coercive interrogation. He was present at least some of those meetings. These were, again, this was the group that was chaired by then head of the Rice, then head of the National Security, the National Security Advisor, the President. And there was an oddly kind of, you know, ritual character to something that to Powell's performance, and which I think he was trying to suggest something to people who were listening. So what he kept on saying, so Matt, I would say, well, you know, what happened at these meetings, and were you opposed to this, or, you know, where did this initiative come from? And he kept on saying things like, well, you know, I wasn't at all of the meetings. I don't recall everything was said at the meetings. What people really would need to do is to look at the written record, because there is a full written record of all of these meetings. And then she would push him again, and he would say, well, I wasn't at all of these meetings. But you people should look. Now, I think the message from Powell, who, you know, according to people who are much closer to these, look much more closely at these issues than me, Powell was a kind of force of opposition to this all along. Maybe, I don't know if that's true. Right. That's what I understand from people I say who don't. It would be, somebody is going to do a great service. You know, these are presidential documents, so it's going to be hard for people to get their hands on them, but I think somebody is going to do a great service by getting a hold of the written record of these meetings, and I think it may go some way to answering the kind of question that you're asking. You know, I doubt that somebody put it exactly this way, but somebody might have said at this meeting, hey, listen, let's go, you know, let's go beat the shit out of these people. You know, let me give John Yoo a call, and you know, or a call and say, hey, could you write us a memo saying it's okay? It's not going to be exactly like that, but I think it's important to know, was somebody at these meetings saying, of course this is torture?
I mean, I would say two things. One, I think that those will be the hardest things to get, and those will be be the kind of thing that the Obama administration will actually be the most reluctant to open up.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, the precedent set by doing that. Second, I think from what we know, we know a lot about what went on, and we'll know more. I mean, you know, from Ron Suskind and others, we know a lot about the ways in which Cheney and Addington and others actually worked behind the scenes, so that there was probably a level beyond what happened at those principal meetings. You know, there's all the stuff with Cheney about, you know, the meeting ends, and then Cheney's with meetings would end, and Cheney would be with the president afterwards, and some other thing would be agreed, and, you know, Addington in particular, who was Cheney's counsel, would kind of go around and produce a different result than people even thought they were getting. So, you know, some of it, I don't want to doubt Cheney, and I didn't even see the segment, but I bet you that if you had those documents, you would still be one step away from the actual chain of the relationship between the policymakers and you, et cetera, that produced these results.
That may well be right, though these were the meetings that you know, John Ashcroft came out of one of these meetings and said, you know, why are we talking about this stuff in the White House? History will not look
kindly on
this.
That's right.
And you know, that's not you saying that.
No, it's not. I mean, I think the moment, and when we found out about the whole John Ashcroft hospital bed scenario which had to do with the surveillance, we all realized that when you've shocked the conscience of John Ashcroft, you're in a different, you know, we're not just motivated by our crazy leftism here, but
you're not worried about John Wells looking over your shoulder. This is more elemental than that.
But
you know, I think I'm sure virtually every place in the world where there have been revelations of this kind that have come out, there's always a temptation to say, best to look to the future, best to move forward, revisit these issues of the past. But past is precedent, and I think it's really, I think there's got to be a more forthright facing up to these issues than there's been. And having read the stuff about the caterpillar in the box in the torture rooms, you know, putting insects crawling around in the box and slamming people into the walls and waterboarding no more than twice a day, et cetera, et cetera, and together with the kind of language in which all of this is cast, I mean, it's something that this is the kind of thing that you do again unless you're prepared in advance with the thought that this is what we do.
And you know, frankly, I mean, I've always been an advocate of a kind of truth commission kind of model. And wrote something about it a couple of years ago. And you don't do that just for revenge or deterrence. You know, you don't do it just for those. You do it because that is the process of putting it in the past. Is making sure you understand fully what happened and how it happened and why it happened. And, you know, fully understanding all, you know, whether John Yoo spends the rest of his life as a tenured member of the Berkeley faculty or in jail where he belongs is less important to me than really understanding everything there is to be known about how a country gets to the point where something like this happens. Not just it's easy to understand how certain things happen on September 12th, 2001, but it's a lot harder to understand the elaborateness of what's going on, you know, as late as 2005. It's just it's just stunning, and we have to know it for all those reasons. I'd go a certain distance actually in immunizing people in order to know the truth. You know, I'm not sure how far I'd go with immunizing. I'm not sure exactly where I'd draw the line on who I'd immunize. I'm not sure I'd immunize everybody, but to really understand everything that happened is more important, I think, for putting it in the past and for our future than that everybody be appropriately punished.
Punishment issue. I don't know. I think it depends on further stuff that comes out. Although I think that there's, as you said earlier, sufficiently much stuff that comes out already that there's a pretty good case for moving forward on. There's a value not just for addressing what's happened in the past, but for having some kind of clear lines as you move forward.
Right.
Where you say this is you don't do this, and I guess I'm one of the things that I'm curious about these discussions that take place on the Principles Committee is it really is an issue about the kind of moral culture of this of the country and of this group of people in particular. Is there somebody at these things saying this is wrong and we shouldn't do it, and what kind of opposition does that meet with, or is this all a discussion, is this all a kind of tough guy discussion?
Right.
You know, let's go and beat the shit out of a couple of people and, fuck them up and or whatever and do whatever we need to do and in order to get the information out. Right. And then with no sense that there are lines, beyond which you don't go. I think it would be good to. So it would be nice to know that, but I also think it's important not just to know what happened, but to have some ideas about who's done stuff who's done stuff that's wrong.
Right.
Moving on, we were going to talk a little bit about. I guess it's about political scientists and journalists. Is that?
I guess so.
There was a comment of, I'm pointing the finger now. There was a comment of yours that I saw referred to recently. You wrote a piece called "Grading Election Theories."
Right. It was a quickie piece that I wrote for our website shortly after the election. Looking at some of the little theories of how the election would play out, I'm not sure I even remember all of them now. But I gave them randomly, not random, but lightly assigned letter grades. And one thing I've learned being at the Prospect and you know, having much more involvement in our website. And I guess I should have known this, having done some blogging. But, you know, anything that you do that's a list that's easily accessible. We just had a great piece by Adam Serwer on the kind of report card on the administration and civil liberties. Mm-hmm. You know, anything you do that's got that kind of list quality just goes out everywhere. People get huge pickup. So that got a ton of pickup. And I made a little bit of fun of the yeah. kind of economic determinist right. theories of election results.
You gave him a B.
I gave him a B. I don't really remember. You know, I was very clear about how arbitrary it was. It's like, I don't like them. They take the drama out of the
right, so this is that you said it's no fun without the melodrama.
Right, right, right. I mean, there
now,
was...
Here's the thing that I don't... There's an interesting issue here. It's an opening on an interesting okay. issue. So you have these... I mean, the backdrop here is that there is a kind of brewing fight between, you know, the political scientists and, you know, the insightful, interesting, you know, political journalists. You know, all right. kinds of political scientists are, you know, going after Tom Frank and think that he doesn't really understand American elections
right.
and like that.
Right.
So we got these economic models.
Frank's theory being that people... operate in contradiction to their economic interests.
They operate. That's right. As people stylize it, a kind of right. false consciousness
right.
theory
right.
that you know, low-income voters suffer from.
Right.
So as I understood your point in this thing, you say, okay, so these economic models predict the outcome of the election, but they get a B because they don't pick up any of the melodrama. So, that, you know, the criticism is that they only get things right.
The problem is if you make your living and you get... The problem is that you come out of the end of the 2008 election cycle and you've been caught up in this, you know, for 3 months it's been McCain versus Obama and the ups and downs, and yeah. for a while you thought maybe McCain might really win and maybe Sarah Palin was this great masterstroke and you know, there's all these ups and downs about the election, and then you come down in the end and Obama wins but you've taken yourself on this roller coaster ride, and then you come out of it and the kind of economically determinist political scientists said, well, that was what the outcome was going to be all along, because when the GDP is X and the unemployment rate is Y and the GDP deflator is minus 0.1, result is the out party wins by 6 percentage points. And, you know, then so what'd you waste your time with all that other stuff? Was that just noise and static? And if you know that, you kind of can't enjoy the drama of what was actually a really fun and dramatic year. I mean, if you didn't have that sort of moment of... I don't think I ever quite fell for this, but if you didn't have that moment of scare of, oh my God, what if Sarah Palin really is a masterstroke, and what if people really do think Obama's a Muslim, and if you didn't let yourself get sort of swung around a little bit, the whole thing would lose a lot of its interest. And for those of us who that right. the main thing we do is we write about it, we focus on it. I mean, it makes the whole thing a bit of a waste. And they mostly do get it right. I mean, there is underlying it that underlying economic issue, which of course you realize now. I mean, you realize now that for all the what we think Obama should do, for all the stuff we're arguing about, the one thing that matters most is, you know, get the thing right, get the economy right. And I don't care about any ideology. You know, more important than any kind of worldview I have tells me the answer is I desperately want him to get it right. The economy has to be improving by 2010 and in pretty good shape by 2012 for a whole bunch of reasons. But it does take
but
a little...
So, but, yeah, but, so you... Little but then what happens, next? I mean, do you come out of this thinking that... is the lesson of this that campaigning doesn't matter?
I don't draw that. I mean, I think it's interesting how reliable the economic models often are, not always. Yeah. They certainly, I think 88, I think the Dukakis race was one where they, I can't remember which ones they were. They've been
2004. And you could say either that's, you know, because there are these unusually overwhelming concerns about
national security,
terrorism, foreign policy, or because John Kerry turned out to be such a incredibly pathetic candidate that he squandered the underlying advantages that he came into the election. They predicted the real winner in 2000 pretty well, but not the winner of the
Supreme Court
took office.
Yeah. Right.
I mean, one of the things that I think that happens here is, so if you look back at the discussions about, you know, that were going on during the campaign about the kind of perfection with which Obama ran the campaign. And so people say, look, he's running this perfect campaign. This is why he's doing as well as he's doing. My guess is that if you look more closely at the way he was running the campaign, probably what was happening was that people were not that concerned about mistakes that he was making because of the condition of the economy. Mm-hmm. So it's not that there was a kind of, you know, he didn't seem like he was doing anything wrong. He probably was doing a lot of things wrong.
Right.
It just didn't, people weren't paying attention to it. Or if you take a look at, you know, McCain, so he goes for Sarah Palin. In the fullness of time, this emerges as a, you know, a blunder.
Right.
Lots of opposition to Sarah Palin. Is it that you know, the underlying economic structural forces didn't really matter as much as people think? Well, no, I think the situation that he was in, that McCain was in, was that he knew that he had to be throwing some Hail Marys.
Absolutely.
And that's what he was
told. That's absolutely right. Yeah, that's absolutely right. When you're going, you know, you're cutting against so much, you have to make a big play, and the big play is likely to blow up, whereas Obama could take, you know, a vice presidential choice that actually really didn't add a whole lot, but was entirely safe and added a dimension of experience. It was actually somebody who you can imagine would be a pretty decent vice president. Well, that's, you know, I think that's right.
So my guess is that's right. So my guess is that if the economy had been performing pretty well and Obama had, offered the vice presidential slot to Joe Biden, people would have been saying, as a few people said at the time, oh, God, this is a terrible blunder. This isn't going to do anything for him.
Right.
But it looks like, you know, God, as the campaign evolved, another really, really good decision. Well, it's because there's a kind of, you know, a certain kind of rosy-colored glasses that people have on because he has this huge underlying advantage. I mean, what I'm thinking is, you know, if you go back to the early 80s, right after Reagan is elected. So for the first, you know, eventually Reagan emerges as the Teflon president, right? So no criticism sticks to Reagan. If you look back in 81 and up through about October, November of 82, Reagan was really unpopular.
Oh, yeah.
And what happened,
especially in the recession of 82.
That's right.
And then,
what happened?
If you look back and you read, you know, the mistakes that they made on Social Security alone in that first couple of years were colossal.
Right. So what happens is when the economy starts doing better after, you know, I think in August 82, the stock market bottoms out, economy starts doing better, suddenly Reagan looks like a political genius.
Yeah.
But he's kind of basking in the reflected glory of the improved performance of the economy.
Yeah.
So it's, you know, I think there's a, you know, I think it's complicated to think about how these, you know, the horse race factors together with the underlying structural factors. But it's not that I think that the horse race doesn't matter or that the campaigning doesn't matter. It's that I think that to a large extent our perceptions of the smartness of the decisions are, you know, framed by these, you know, underlying concerns about the state of the underlying concerns about the state of the economy.
Right. But unfortunately, you know, you're probably right. And you know, there's a parallel, of course, with the like Wall Street. When things are going well, we think, oh, these, you know, John Thane is such a genius. Yeah. Merrill Lynch profits. You know, Jack Welch is a genius. They're all geniuses, and of course, they all deserve what, you know, goes back to the question of dessert and merit, and of course you've earned all these things, and you know when the economy is in that shape, anybody can any idiot can make money, and when and look like a genius, and then it's not, and they all look like clowns.
Right. So I, you know, there's this phenomenon in social psychology called the fundamental attribution error.
Right.
So the fundamental attribution error is that when something happens to somebody else, you always think that it happens as a consequence of some feature of the person.
Right.
It's not the situation
right.
that they're in.
Right.
It's the person. And then when it happens to you, you think, you know, the situation is really
right,
bad.
Right, right.
But this idea that what you should do, and it goes back to our earlier conversations about ideas about, you know, dessert and merit.
Right.
There's a very strong predisposition to treat, you know, the accidents of, you know, good fortune and bad fortune
right.
as somehow reflecting something, some intrinsic, deserving, undeserving, meritorious, unmeritorious feature of the person,
right.
and not to pay attention to the these situational. Situational factors, except when something bad happens
right.
to us, in which case it's the bad structural situation.
Right.
But you know, project good fortune into deserved fortune and bad fortune to, you know, undeserved fortune. So I think, you know, it's true that Obama ran a really good campaign, but it's also true that it was really, and not to take away from it exactly, but it was kind of easier to run a really good campaign in 2008 because of the kinds of things that these, the economic models describe.
Sadly, I think you're right. However, I will say one thing. When you do a really good Blogging Heads, it's all you.
When it's you do a really good Blogging Heads, it's all
us,
you.
When any of us. When you do, when one does a really bad one, it's anyway. That was my graceful way of saying we should wrap this up.
We should wrap this up. Very good to
talk,
Mark.
Lovely to talk to you, Josh, and look forward to doing this again. And then we'll talk about your some of the great things you've written recently in Boston Review.
And same with American Prospect.
Okay.
Good to talk.
All right.
Okay.
Thanks. Bye-bye. Bye now.